Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a specialist on Latin America, and in particular, our close neighbor, Mexico. As a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations recently, Dr. Diana Negroponte looked at the challenges globalization have given to two of the largest economies south of the United States, Mexico and Brazil. Negroponte, the spouse of longtime diplomat John Negroponte, is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in their Latin American initiative of the institution's foreign policy program. Previous to her work at Brookings, she served as a senior scholar at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She recently published The End of Nostalgia, Mexico Confronts the Challenges of Global Competition. She's also published numerous articles and publications on the region, including the 2012 book Seeking Peace in El Salvador. In addition to her work on Latin American economic and security policies, she's also devoted a great deal of time to social and development issues, particularly in Honduras, where she worked actively with refugees displaced by civil wars in two neighboring countries, and in Mexico, where she built low-income homes in city slums and initiated a program for the artistic development of people with disabilities. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this month, and I spoke with her while she was here. Diana Negroponte, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
You're speaking to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on the issues of globalization for Brazil and Mexico. But let's start with Mexico. President of Mexico, along with the Prime Minister of Canada and President Obama, met just here in the last few days in Toluca. It was the first trilateral meeting in a while of the North American Free Trade Agreement partners. What happened at that particular meeting?
Rich, the most important is that they actually met, because they haven't met in 2010, in 2011, or in 2013. So there was doubt that there was any political grit or purpose in the meeting. So I'm, first of all, very pleased that they met. Secondly, they addressed a number of nuts and bolts issues. Nothing strategic, nothing headline, but amongst those nuts and bolts, that trusted traveler card that enables you to go through the TSA line fast will now be available as you cross the Mexican border and the Canadian border. In other words, one card, one program, two borders. This will make a considerable difference to people who are moving the products, carrying the ideas in their head or in their briefcase. Because it's essential that if we're going to work on a North American basis, the people are able to travel and exchange ideas.
Well, it's interesting because when the North American Free Trade Agreement first came in, we had pretty open borders. I mean, Canadians moved into the United States, vice versa, Mexico, United States, legal as well as illegal in that case. But we had fairly open borders. But since 9/11, we've had very closed borders. And a lot of those old sort of minglings became a far more difficult thing to do. Has it had a direct impact on trade and how we conduct our relationships?
Yes. It's had a serious impact. It's called the thickening of the border, which means that the procedures by customs authorities to ensure that that truck doesn't only carry the manifest of widgets and boxes, but might also be carrying people, as well as cocaine, methamphetamine. So the border has now become a prolonged and laborious crossing. But for many of the goods in the automotive industry, that final product, the component parts for that final product, will cross the border up to 8 times. That means 8 waits at the border. So if we are to be truly a North American manufacturer, a North American producer of ideas and innovative products, we have to find a way to modernize the border. And the way to do it is, as the truck container leaves the factory gates, the contents are known to U.S. Customs at that time. You then seal that truck to ensure that it isn't tampered. And it then sets off from factory gates up to Tulsa, on to Detroit, without stopping. That is where we've got to get to.
Of course, a lot of our American productivity gains, as well as productivity within the region, has been based on just-in-time inventory. So that free flow of material is absolutely critical to maintaining the productivity.
That also requires that we have modern infrastructure. The Windsor Bridge needs to have enough crossings. The Laredo Bridge needs to be accessible 24 hours a day. That it closes at 8 p.m.
Does it really?
Not because the CBP want to go home, but because the Mexican brokers on their side consider that their days come to an end. Well, in our modern world where we do everything 24/7, closing down the border crossing at 8 p.m. is antique.
Interesting. So it was working out a lot of these things at the summit. Well, it seems like despite all these difficulties, trade has continued to really grow between these three countries. I think the latest figure I saw was about $500 billion a year in shared imports between the three. That's a pretty good figure. And what's interesting for those critics of NAFTA, the United States is about a third of that total.
Rich, the potential is much greater than that which we have succeeded. Yes, we've quadrupled trade in goods. Yes, we've quintupled trade in services. But the potential among three countries, which have the benefits of natural resources, highly skilled human capital, and a workforce ready to participate is much greater than what we're doing at the moment. But governments have got to catch up with the private sector. The private sector needs better infrastructure, better rail, the crossings at the bridge, which we talked about, to enable the skilled and innovative ideas in these three countries to be realized. And if we don't, Asia's going to eat our lunch.
The infrastructure, if anything, the talk is about making it more difficult to cross borders rather than making it easier to cross borders. I mean, I think a lot of the political rhetoric is about making it more difficult.
The rhetoric is about the crossings between the borders. The focus from the Republican Party on strengthening the border before we move towards a comprehensive immigration is more focused on what happens between the entry points. So although those funds might see more Customs and Border Patrol, which properly trained could be very helpful, I think the concern is those who enter Houston Airport, Los Angeles dockside, they enter legally, but they overstay their visa. And so those are the points in which the more conservative members of our society are asking for reinforcement.
But I've heard about the Windsor Bridge for a number of years, and yet nothing's happened on that front.
Well, that's because there is a very wealthy gentleman who owns the bridge, and he doesn't want to see competition.
My guest today is Diana Negroponte. She's a non-resident senior fellow in the Latin American Initiative for the Brookings Institution, as we talk about the issues confronting Brazil and Mexico. She spoke about that to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations in regards to globalization. And in your book, The End of Nostalgia, which you edited and also contributed a number of pieces to, you talked about the challenge of global competition for Mexico. And you said there's sort of two groups. There is it's the people entering the workforce, the professional workforce in Mexico. They're anxious for this global competition. They see it as a benefit to Mexico. Yet you have this other side, which has basically depended on government, you know, long-term government contracts, and also the society's own sort of social structure. So prominent families get a lot of extra concessions. And of course, there's corruption as well. And it says that these two are competing right now. Talk about that competition, if you will.
There's stress within the Mexican society, but it's a very creative stress. As you rightly identified, this is a patriarchal society in which the father dominates the public appearance of that family and ensures that people who need a job, whether they be first cousins or godsons or maybe sons and daughters of those who work for him, are looked after. So there is considerable care and patronage offered by those in power. Against this is a younger generation, a generation many of whom are educated here in Tulsa, as well as in other major schools in the United States, who are saying, Dad, I don't get this job because I'm your son or grandson or nephew. I get this job because I'm better, I'm more skilled, I'm smarter, and I'm ready to work harder. That's the future for Mexico, and that's the transition which is being made. But here's the stumbling block. 45% of Mexicans work in what's called the informal sector. That is, you're working out of your house, you don't pay taxes, you don't invest in research and development. And so this formidable informal sector, which employs 48% of the young men and women aged 18 to 27, 48%, nearly half, isn't developing, isn't modernizing. They are continuing to make wonderful tortillas, repair your axle in your car, but they're not producing the creative entrepreneurial skills which the 21st century needs. So how do you persuade a society that the formal sector can be beneficial? That's the challenge.
Now, give us a sense of the extent of that informal economy. You mentioned tortilla makers, you mentioned auto mechanics, but I would assume it's a far greater range of industries that, unlike here in the United States, even an informal economy still is subject to taxation. It sounds like they're not there, so that's problematic for the government as well.
It is, because the fiscal revenue collected is among the lowest in the OECD countries. Mexico has a great difficulty collecting taxes. There is a cultural attitude that if you pay taxes, you're dumb. Whereas...
Is that go to the corruption sort of that's been a part of the government over the years, or...?
No, it's related more to the fact that my patron will look after me when I'm in need. My patron is not the government. My patron is an individual. My patron is a political party. My patron may be the owner of a large enterprise. So my reliance and my loyalty is to that patron.
That sounds feudal.
Not to the state.
That sounds feudal.
There are elements.
Or it could be a person within the state who has a state job, but the patronage is not for a constituency. It's more towards family, nepotism, that sort of thing?
It's family. It's a very wide social security network, so long as you remain loyal. Now, a younger generation is challenging this, and the younger generation is saying, you can't assume that my vote goes to the party, which in the past years has been the PRI. I want that independence of thought. I want the ability to be able to challenge the ideas of the party in power, and greater freedom of expression and greater freedom of thought necessarily brings with it the capacity to be ingenious and creative, preferably licitly.
Mm. You mentioned the PRI. The PRI was out of power for a short amount of time. Now they're back in power. Has that been healthy for the political system in Mexico, or are the PRI just basically trying to extend sort of this another long regency period of power, or... Are there really good, healthy political parties now in Mexico?
Alternation was very important. The fact that an alternate party could come, could be voted in, the PAN, the center-right, they could be voted in and re-voted. So they had 12 years in power, and now there's alternation. We understand that in the United States. Question, during those 12 years out of power, did the old PRI modernize? And there's no clear answer. There are some old-timers, they're called the dinosaurs. And they were the ones who chose this young, attractive president, Enrique Peña Nieto. They carry considerable sway within the party. They will remember the old ways. They will remember the patronage systems. And the tendency will be for them to consolidate once again those old patronage systems. Against that, you've got smart, well-educated technocrats trained here in Tulsa University who are saying, world's changing, we cannot stay still. We have to change too. And the modernization of Mexico depends on that younger generation saying, let's respect the past, but let's make the future happen.
So you've sort of detailed this conflict between old ways and new ways, not only on the political front, but the economic front. Which side has the upper hand at this particular point?
The modernizers. And that is demonstrated by the fact that the young incoming president from the old party has introduced 7 major reforms: banking, telecommunication, education, labor, and most important of all, energy. Energy used to be a quasi-religious issue. After 1938, when the Mexican government nationalized Standard Oil of New Jersey and the other great U.S. and British companies, that oil, the refining, the petrochemicals, all downstream, even the gas stations, all belonged to the state.
Pemex.
Pemex. In December, this young pre-president, supported by that younger generation of dynamic entrepreneurs and educated people, said, "We're going to open Pemex up. Pemex can have 90 days to choose which fields it wishes to operate, and it must prove that it can operate them commercially or go into joint venture with independents from Oklahoma and from the U.S. But after that time, there will be an open bidding process. And the purpose of this is to attract foreign investment and private investment from within Mexico, because that's the only way that Mexico is going to be able to take advantage of the extraordinary reserves that it holds. Estimated 90 billion barrels.
Yeah, which I think most neutral observers would say Pemex has done a really poor job of exploiting those reserves over the years.
I agree.
Is Pemex in any case nimble enough to make that transition in 90 days?
Pemex has already begun to identify the fields and the wells that it wishes to keep. And of course, the list is probably much longer than is actually operable. But they will establish that these are the fields that they'd like to have a shot at. And remember, under the new laws, they can enter into a joint venture for the management and operation of that field. Hmm. So the problem is not so much Pemex holding on as it is Pemex selecting who's it going to do business with.
So they're going to take on partners.
They have to. Yeah. They haven't got the human resources, they haven't got the finances, nor the technical capability to manage. Some of those oil wells are called half-eaten apples. You know how you bite into an apple and then you leave the rest because it's rotten or dry or whatever? Well, Pemex did the same with some of its oil wells. But if Pemex then enters into a joint venture with a company from Tulsa, which knows how to extract the oil from that kind of a field.
Same thing we're doing in the United States right now.
Then the potential is great.
And I think you've written that you see this as the big new trade area for these groups of nations, both Canada, the United States, and Mexico's energy production.
We will be self-sufficient in energy in 2020. That's 6 years from now. Self-sufficient doesn't mean we're independent. We're still going to be trading for different types of oil. But the fact that we're self-sufficient,
that doesn't mean oil's going to be cheaper either, because world demand will keep the price up.
I'm not sure about that, Rich, because the price of shale oil at $2 a BTU compared to what it was 2008 when we started indicates the price of electricity is going to fall significantly. That's going to make North American manufacturing much more competitive. I'm very optimistic about this.
All right. My guest today is Diana Negroponte, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in the Latin American Initiative, and she was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, not only did you talk about, or you're talking about Mexico with the committee, but you're also speaking about Brazil. And Brazil has been this, you know, Brazil and Argentina, you know, they go up and then they go down, and they, you know, the economies seem to soar and then crash. But right now, Brazil is doing better, I think, than most people would have thought, say, 10 years ago. And it's set to be the showcase of the world for the next couple of years, with the World Cup this summer, although Americans probably won't pay that much attention. The rest of the world will. And then the Olympics in 2 years. Now, the question is when you look at the Olympics, you look at Athens, you look at Montreal years ago, the Olympics can crater an economy. Is Brazil mature enough to be able to be the center of this world stage for the next few years?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Brazil is a continent. Its resources are enormous. Its problem is that it has an old-fashioned political structure, which is highly protectionist, which demands very high local content. And that, together with infrastructure, which is 50 to 60 years old, out of date, means that moving into the 21st century and taking advantage of the World Cup and the Olympics is a tremendous challenge. I believe that the Brazilians will pull it off. Maybe the last moment, we may still be painting the fence as the teams march into the stadium, but they'll do it. But here is the rub on it. Brazil is emerging from a predominantly rural society to an urban society earning per capita $9,000 a year. That's middle class in Brazil. That means I want my own car, I want my own refrigerator, we'll take a vacation, and we're going to start thinking more independently because we're no longer dependent upon the same old governor or the same old politician. Now, this middle-class, independent-minded people are saying, you're spending millions on these stadiums in six cities, but what are you spending on our local transport when I have to commute an hour and a half in the morning, an hour and a half in the evening, with no air conditioning, and I don't get a seat on the bus? When I go to the hospital, I have to wait a whole day in line, even though I may be very ill. Brazilians are fed up with their public services, and they look at the money that's being spent on the stadiums, and they said, have the Brazilian politicians got the priorities right?
Well, that's for just the World Cup this summer. In another year or so, you're going to have even a huge, much larger infrastructure footprint for the Summer Olympics. And they're going to have to spend a ton of money for that.
But I heard that when Greece had the Summer Olympics, when London had the Summer Olympics, and of course, we had the Winter Olympics in Sochi. Before that, we all gripe. Not enough toilets, roofs falling in, inadequate infrastructure. But when the games come, we forget all about those gripes and we become so excited on the quality of the athletes, the effort of the athletes, and we're so intensely.
I think the Greeks would be talking about the the cost after the glow of the Olympics because they're still paying for it.
But the Greeks, and I have to admit to you, I'm married to a Greek. The Greeks failed to plan on how they would use the Olympic facilities afterwards. The Brits planned how they would use it.
True.
And so if you've got an ongoing flow of revenue after the great 3 weeks, then you probably can recover the monies. But if all you do is have the great party and at an enormous cost to the taxpayer with no onward, you've got problems looking forward.
Well, beyond these spectacle events, I think you detailed the big issue for Brazilians. The population as a whole are getting more wealthy, although by American standards they have a long way to go. But they are getting more wealthy. They're yearning for that middle-class status. They want cars. Now, the energy industry seems to be pretty well-suited. I know they have this huge ethanol program based on sugarcane, which that's, you know, I think environmentalists were looking at that for a while. It sounds like the government is really lagging behind on providing opportunities for that consumer economy to develop.
Rich, you're right. It's a very rigid bureaucratic system, and it employs lots of people. So when you're going to tell those people, we don't need you anymore, the computer can tell us what the tax rate is going to be or what the regulatory standard's going to be, there is going to be an adjustment which will probably take a generation. Brazil will have to loosen up its regulatory framework, its roadblocks that it has. Let me give you one example. With great fanfare, the president announced that the airports would be privatized, and the hope of a privately run metropolitan authority operating and actually building the airports filled everybody with great excitement, as well as those who wished to bid. When it came down to the facts, they were only offering to privatize the operation of the airport. Mm. But the facilities remain the same old, dilapidated that have existed for 30 years.
And you'd either have to invest that yourself and not make any sort of return for a number of years and hope that you can get your money back at some point, or there's no reason in operating it because there's no upside to it.
Well, there should be an upside. Airports have now become both shopping malls and restaurant depots, and people use airports now as a major part of their life. So there is the capacity to recover your money, but you've got to have investment with the initiative and the determination to see it through.
My guest today is Diana Negroponte, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in the Latin American Initiative, and she's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Secretary of State Kerry had a trip south, and he mentioned our backyard as well as our neighborhood. And, of course, the backyard statement got all sorts of inflamed comment. But in general, is the Obama administration paying enough attention to the rest of the hemisphere?
Depends who you ask. The United States is a world power. We're not just a regional power. And therefore, the president and the government of the United States have to be concerned about Ukraine, North Korea, Iran. So sometimes we take our hemisphere for granted. And of course, the people in the hemisphere grumble that we do that. But you know, President Obama's been to Mexico 5 times. In the last year, Vice President Biden has been down to Mexico, Secretary Kerry. They've also been down to Brazil. They've been in El Salvador. They've been in Colombia. So while the citizens of the hemisphere say they would like to have greater attention, they may forget that during the Cold War, they wish there was less Washington attention, and they wish they didn't have their hemisphere used as a fulcrum in Cold War disputes. It's better now. We no longer treat or relate to Latin America in that way. But as a result, we may not necessarily be able to provide that full attention that was given in the past.
All right. Well, Diana Negroponte, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you. I've enjoyed our meeting.
Latin American specialist Dr. Diana Negroponte speaking with us back in early March when she was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. She's currently a senior fellow in the Latin American Initiative under the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.